Music session number 12097, reel 1.
Admiral Jack, reel 1. Could we start off with your telling me where you were born, please?
I was born at Portland in Dorset, where my father was the naval stores officer. And incidentally, the house which was supplied for him as a junior stores officer is now the Admiral's residence.
Where were you educated?
I was educated eventually at St. Lawrence College at Ramsgate.
And how did you come to be in the Fleet Air Arm?
I'd always set my heart on getting to the Navy. And having thought flying would be a very good idea, I liked the idea of it as well. Sat the various exams, failed for the Navy, was deciding whether I would go to Cranwell, the Marines, or something else. And finally I scraped in the bottom of the engineering list, went to the Airbus, managed to transfer to executive, then had to decide whether it was submarines or flying, because that was the only way you could afford to run a car in those days, $6 a day extra. And eventually decided the Fleet Air Arm, because by doing that and specialising in swordfish, I could guarantee to spend the summer of 1937 at Gosport racing my latest 12-foot dinghy in Chichester Harbour. Thus is one's career decided.
What did you think of the training that you received for the Fleet Air Arm?
It was great fun. We were trained by the RAF. Most of our instructors were younger and junior than we were. And up at Lucas, we had the RAF teaching the Navy and the Army how to fly. Flying instruction was first class, no doubt about it. I was actually the first student of the first ever flight sergeant pilot instructor.
What were you doing when war broke out?
I just been sent down to Hasler. I damaged my back and was still in Hasler. Instead of going back to my squadron, they put me into torpedo training unit for the next 18 months to my intense annoyance. So that was 810 Squadron I was in Ark Royal at the time.
Why were you so annoyed?
Well, I wanted to get back to my squadron.
What was your reaction when you heard that we were at war with Germany?
I think one of considerable depression. I didn't think it was a very clever idea. I'm purely, I think I'd always felt that I'd been curious enough, I had a great friend who was a German at school, and always generally that they were a rather pleasant bunch of the French. It was my own personal feeling, but and it seemed a pity to have a war, get a bit more of them. The whole thing seemed a bit stupid, but of course one realised with Hitler it had to happen, because we should have got rid of him years before. Of course he hadn't had the sense to do it, so it was now inevitable, but a pity.
What did you think at the time when war was declared about our prospects against Germany? Did you feel confident about it or not?
Not very, no, because we were totally inadequately prepared for it. In particular, I was very prejudiced, having spent 2 years as a midshipman in HMS Nelson flagship and seeing what the guns could do. I was absolutely convinced that we were just throwing money down the drain and building battleships instead of carriers. I think most of us in the Fleet Air Arm felt the same.
But you came across a lot of opposition in the Navy to your point of view.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, the Fleet Air Arm was regarded as a pain by the senior officers. These wretched aeroplanes were... They had a value for reconnaissance, but that was their limit as far as they were concerned, the majority of them, I think. There were a few exceptions, of course. Dennis Boyd was the absolute classic. Several, to be fair. But the very large majority of the senior officers of the Navy reckoned the battleship was the answer, not the carrier.
What changed the point of view?
Places like the actions. I suppose Taranto was the first really telling one. Various other actions, the men. Because our biggest problem, though, was the inability to look after the anti-submarine war. See, before the war, the RAF was given the first priority was the defence of Britain, Fighter Command. Second was the bombing of the enemy, Bomber Command. Third was the war at sea, Coastal Command. Now, they hadn't got enough money for one of those jobs, let alone three, so not unnaturally, you can't blame the RAF. Bottom of the priority was Coastal Command. Now, had that been the Navy, for the Navy, the top priority was the anti-submarine war, the defence of the convoys, bringing food into the country and supplies. And this is where the big problem we had. The RAF, the aircraft which we had, couldn't get out into the Atlantic other than in carriers, and we hadn't got enough of them. And we only have about two men and a boy in Coastal Command. And hard though they tried, they just hadn't got the aircraft or the resources or the money to develop them. This is an appalling position we were in at the start of the war for that reason. And why? Of course, we lost such a fantastic number of ships in the Atlantic. And that wasn't really one of the tragedies there. It was the Ayres brothers who were shipping a big way. They put forward quite early the idea of building a flight deck on merchant ships which would carry a few anti-submarine aircraft. And it was two solid years before that was started. Anyone even made any attempt to do it. First of all, of course, we had the little carriers, which were solely carriers. And then we had the merchant aircraft carriers, and I was in quite early in that development in the Aberdeen. You sacrificed 10% of the cargo of that ship, and you had four anti-submarine aircraft on board. But it, unfortunately, by the time we got him into action, it was really too late. The war was almost over, the anti-submarine war. The one occasion, I think I'm right in saying, where they had something like 40 swordfish, anti-submarine swordfish, protecting one convoy. Which, of course, was, had we had that right through the war, would have made a hell of a difference.
Now, to pick up on your career again, can you tell me something about the kind of things you did on the torpedo training?
Well, it just was getting a course of, I was about to say youngsters, but then of course we've got people like Bill Garthwaite, who was a lot older than I, and given you were given 6 weeks to teach them to fly the swordfish and to come in, make some sort of attack and drop the torpedo correctly. And we started at Gosport, and then we went up to Abbots Inch, which could scarcely be more unsuitable because it was quite a long way from the sea, so we had to flog down to the Clyde, where we had Soppa's yacht Valentia as the target, and then finally moved across to a new naval air station at Crail. I had about 6 months in each of those places.
What did the technique involve of dropping the torpedoes?
Well, coming diving down, levelling off at about 20 feet, just long enough to steady yourself, then assessing the speed and the angle of the ship, whether or not she was going to turn away or towards you, and then using a rather simple sight, which was a row of little torch bulbs on a bar in front of you. It didn't really help much. And just aiming off, you hope the right amount, dropping at the right range, at the right speed and the right height, so the torpedo would run. And that last part was pretty vital. You dropped it too high or too low, Too low, wasn't it? Quite so serious, but too high. He was liable to break up. You weren't likely to drop it too fast and string back, because it wouldn't go too fast. But you needed to get the aircraft at about 20 feet and hold it steady. And on the later developments, where we had a plane on the back of the torpedo with a wire on it that ran off and took 3 seconds to do to steady it in its early flight, because if you jinked away too soon, you'd chuck it away and push it bows first straight into the sea. It was quite an intensive course getting them up to a reasonable stage in 6 weeks. And the next bunch arrived.
Did the torpedoes often fail to drop?
No, we're using dummy torpedoes for all the whole time, because they usually released all right. We dropped, first of all, just to get them used to drop, which didn't run. Then we had the runners. And recorded whether or not they would have hit. We usually set deep so they went under the target ship, but we had. We always had at least one instructor on board the ship assessing the flights. They came giving their criticisms afterwards. Of course, unfortunately, we didn't have any radio then, so we couldn't call them up and tell them straight away. But the great thing, most of the attacks were done with a camera gun. And as you came in, you pressed the button to release the torpedo and got a photograph of the ship. And from that, you could assess the height of the aircraft by the relationship of the horizon and the ship, the range by the length of the ship, and knowing the angle of the ship, whether or not the torpedo would have hit. And that was the most it was done with the camera gun. And then they went on to actually dropping dummy torpedoes just to get the feel of the release, although there wasn't very much difference. And finally, dropping a few runners.
What do you think were the personal qualities required for a successful torpedo bomber pilot?
He had to be reasonably good. He had to be able to fly in formation in cloud, which is one of our problems. Get him used to that. If you're not a very experienced pilot, there you are, tucked in, you can see your leader, and you know perfectly well that if you lose him, you've got a problem, because you don't know where you are. You don't know whether this particular cloud's full of mountains or. They really had to get into their heads that once they got in formation, they got to stay there. We lost a few, didn't.
Can you tell me what you and your fellow pilots thought about flying the Swordfish at that stage of the war, flying a biplane?
Well, at the time, we thought it was plain bloody stupid. We wanted a decent, fast monoplane. But when we got into action and they got hit and went on flying, we began to think perhaps it wasn't such a bad idea anyway. But there's no doubt that it was far too slow. From the other point, and the range, of course, was so restricted too, compared to what we would like to have had. Because the last time you got anything was the Grumman Avenger. And that wasn't until 43, I think, we first got theirs.
Were you under great discomfort in flying the plane?
If it was cold, yes. You were in an open cockpit, of course. And normally speaking, you didn't fly for more than about 4 hours, but later I was going on 7.5, 8.25, I think was the longest we did. Got a bit boring.
But did the pilots develop an affection for the plane?
Oh, I think so, yes, because it was very reliable, and because he flew so slowly, if you did have to land it in emergency anywhere, a sporting chance you stepped out of it. Whereas anything that came in faster, you were less likely to. I landed one night and absolute pitch black, couldn't see a damn thing, and he was blowing 45 knots, and the next morning I could see where the front wheels had touched down, and the tail wheel was in that same place. It only run the length of the aircraft.
Can we now go on to 825 Squadron? Can you tell me about joining that?
Yep, I was appointed to it at Macri Hennish, the senior pilot, with Esmond, the CEO. And there we were working up, we didn't know where we were going, but worked the whole squadron up as a torpedo and bombing squadron. And I think we'd had about 3 weeks there. Hadn't really done any combined attacks at all when we got this panic order to get on board Victorious. As senior pilot, I had a slight problem because Victorious had absolutely no swordfish stores at all. She was stored entirely for albacores. Unfortunately, at that time, I knew all the stores people fairly well, and they did a super job and bundled some stores up. We assumed, of course, we were going to remain in the ship for some time. We didn't know that this was just for the Bismarck attack, and then to go out to Ark Royal. Anyhow, we duly joined her with Dr. Scarpa. And joined her. Went off, did a bit of flying, sort of anti-submarine patrols. And then the attack. And then, which of course was a shambles, because we had radar on the Mark II ASV, which had a couple of an aerial each side. And the observer had his box, and he got a blip, and then the pilot had to turn until the size was equal, which meant you were heading at it. Thus you got the direction the target was in. And unfortunately, Norfolk, at the back of my aircraft, had a complete picture of him. He got the Bismarck, he got the shadowing ship, and he got this unfortunate American Coast Guard who was cutting around at the same time there. But Colin Enova in Esmond's aircraft didn't. His set wasn't working very well. And finally Esmond let down on Sheffield, which was the shadowing ship, recognised it, but we'd lost all our hard-won height by then. But we had no intercom, radio intercom. All the signalling was done by hand signals doing sort of this Morse code signalling between the hands of the observer or air gunner, and we were able to point. Then he sighted the Bismarck and just went boring straight in. Well, there's no point in the rest of the squadron going in with him because she merely had to turn and comb all the torpedoes. And I pulled off and started to climb, got in a cloud, and that was when the interesting point, because the they were all the stuff they were firing at was bursting ahead. And my gunner remembered the other day that I said, well, you don't have to bother about this bloody stuff. All the lead's falling out the time we get there. It just smells nasty. And then we discovered after the war that the Germans could not believe any aircraft would ever be flying at less than 100 knots. And they had their fire control system right down as low as it would go, and just weren't doing us any harm. And then again, I saw Esmond going his attack, and finally decided that the only way, because the moment I die, having seen his attack and avoided that, they'd got time to avoid mine. So I nipped down, tried to get in unseen on the water. But they picked us up at the last moment, unfortunately. I was hoping it was bloody rough this year, already keeping right down low. We might get him without them spotting us and loose the torpedo and get out of it. But they picked us up just before we dropped. Oh, just after, I think it was. So I think they probably combed those torpedoes, but Pollard's attack came in, and one of his chaps got lost and came in and made a person lost a private attack, and I think that was probably the one that Bismarck didn't see. He'd caught him. Didn't do much damage, but shook him a bit.
What was the visibility like?
Very patchy. It was a lot of cloud. And you'd see the ship through the cloud, and then the whole lot would go. But actually coming in at last, it was fairly clear. We finally got the tack in. It varied enormously. Suddenly you could see the ship, and then as far as I recall, you run into another batch of cloud. A little bit of cloud between you and the ship, you'd lose her again.
How frightening was it going in to the attack?
Unpleasant. I think it was Bill Garthwaite's observer who told him. And my gunner made the same comment. It wasn't the stuff that went above or below. It was those little things that popped in between the main planes that he disliked so much. It's absolutely staggering how little the aircraft were hit, in fact, in the whole of that attack. Esmond, I think, got three small bullets through. One went just in front of him, one hit, went between him and the observer, the one between the observer and the air gunner, right through the cockpit.
Did the ship look impressive?
Absolutely incredible. I think we were all saying the other night, you know, we all had the same thing. Good God, we can't sink this thing. She's marvellous. I was terribly impressive. She's a beautiful ship.
Was there real determination to sink her, though?
Oh, yes, yes, obviously. And she'd got to go because she was a terrible menace the moment she got out there. They had a lot of tankers. We found one of the tankers, actually, later on our way out to Juba. She had supply ships and tankers out the Atlantic. She could have stayed out there for months, just writing off convoy after convoy. There's nothing that convoy escorts could have done because she could have blown them all. She was faster than any of the escorts. She could have stood outside range of any weapons they had and quietly written off the whole convoy. And it was absolutely vital we should get her. And of course, Churchill gave the order at all costs she must be destroyed.
You flew off from the Victorious or the Ark Royal?
Victorious. Okay. We went out the air department and we flew from Victorious and then went back and replenished and got some more aircraft and from the other squad, the fallen squadron, they lost a few crews too. Well, we'd lost one actually. Pat Jackson was lost but recovered about a fortnight later. And then went out in Victorious to the Mediterranean. Because all the time we had a whole lot of Hurricanes, about 40 of them, in the hangar. And we were operating, the fighters were operating from one end and we were operating from the other. We just great packing cases full of Hurricanes in the middle, which were due to go out to Malta. And it was on the way out, after we'd gone back and replenished to Malta, that we picked up this tanker and supply ship, which were waiting for the Bismarck.
Were you kept fully informed as to the progress of the hunt for the Bismarck?
Yes, I'm sure we were. Yes, I don't specifically remember, but I certainly would have been there.
So you got the news of the sinking of the Hood?
Oh, yes, we got that before we attacked, of course. Yes, that happened the same day, and
how did everybody react to that?
Absolutely shattered. I mean, she was the ship, you know, the mighty Hood was the great ship of the Navy.
And to the news that the Bismarck was finally sunk?
Well, obviously, thank God it was over, because it had happened. But again, I think, certainly I felt that it's a bloody shame we couldn't somehow preserve her, when I get capture her. Well, it's highly improbable, knowing the Germans.
So, this was the first time that you were in action, was it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What happened to you after the attack on the Bismarck?
We transferred to Ark Royal and stayed in her until she was sunk. Which was, November 41, wasn't it? About 6 months, based on Jib. And doing various convoy runs up, Malta convoys, odd raids on bits of Italy, and mainly anti-submarine work. And that's really why I got started on the night anti-submarine stuff, using radar. Because until we had that, of course, the only thing you could do was just patrol in front of the fleet, and if you saw a submarine or a periscope, shout out and try and attack it, carrying a couple of depth charges. But
how exactly did the night anti-submarine work?
Well, you picked it up. I just got started on it in the Ark Royal and managed to persuade my senior officer that we really ought to practice a lot of it. And another squadron, a chap called Woods in 812, I think it was very interested too. In fact, they were based ashore at Gib when the Ark was sunk and carried on with it from there. It meant you picked up a contact of some kind, and the idea you'd go in and illuminate it, and there would be your submarine, you'd go down and attack it. But it wasn't until we got into action, or I got into action later, that we discovered the snag about that was you dropped your flare. If the submarine is pretty quick, it managed to submerge before you got time to get down and attack him.
Were there any incidents that happened to you at this time that you can recount, that stick out in your memory?
I don't know, we did various attacks, we didn't see, I don't think we ever got a certain amount of flak around, and we ever got hit by anything much.
Were you actually on the Ark Royal when it was sunk?
Yes, I was. I just landed on.
Can you describe that in detail? What do you remember of that?
Yeah, Esmond had an engine failure and brought the squadron back early. Well, he'd get land on early. I brought the squadron back. I landed on first, went up the bridge, and eventually on the bridge reporting when the last aircraft came on. So they had called Bird. Did an absolute perfect landing. At that moment, the torpedo hit. And actually, we'd given him a hell of a reprimand that day because he'd broken several aircraft, had bad landings. And he leapt out of the aircraft, I'm told. My God, what have I done this time? Because literally, as he touched down, the bloody torpedo hit. Whole ship shook and clouds of smoke everywhere. And he was quite convinced he'd done something wrong, poor chap. He went on to get a DSO on the channel attack. But I was on the bridge at the time, and we'd started turning out of wind when the ship heeled quite a bit with that, and she started heeling enormously. And I was still on the bridge when she went past her critical angle, which was about 22 degrees, and the captain, not having the slightest inkling of what had happened, had it been an enormous explosion in the ship, we'd no idea it was a torpedo at the time. Quite rightly, I thought at the time, gave the order to abandon ship. Well, there is, in fact, you didn't think quite a lot later. Then we started to do so because she completely lost power. And I collected a few people together and lowered a cutter and went off in it with my observer. And these are artificers, and then realised the ship didn't seem to be sinking, so we came back, shin back on board again.
After how long?
Like 20 minutes or so, half an hour, I don't know. But she didn't seem to be heeding even in one. There weren't many people there, because most of the people